Good morning and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. This morning we have two cases on our docket. Valencia versus State and Ex parte DeRosier. With me on the panel today, we have Justice Bill Meyer to my right and Justice Bonnie Sutter to my left. I believe all counsel for both cases have already checked in. If the clerk will please announce who's arguing today.
May I please report Mr. William B. to argue for the appellant, Mr. David Curl to argue for the state.
All right, Mr. Biggs.
May it please the court. Representing Vincent Valencia, what we're here to argue today is a definition that was applied in a jury instruction in connection with Mr. Valencia's ultimate conviction for injury to a child. The question before this court is whether, and I think there's no dispute that there was an error here, that the definition of intentional was incorrect. The question in this case is whether that resulted from whether egregious harm resulted from that. There's also no dispute that this error is not preserved. Nevertheless, and so we don't dispute that. Nevertheless, we believe that Mr. Valencia can satisfy all four of the factors in the Almanza's test and show egregious harm in this situation. Injury to a child is a result-oriented crime, and you have to specifically intend to cause injury to a child. It's not enough to intend just to effect contact with a child. They have to actually specifically intend to cause injury. This comes up sometimes, the definitions that are given in a jury charge contain both the nature of conduct language and the result of conduct language. This case is a little unique because this definition of intentional is partially has part of the definition of nature and conduct, but not all of it. But I would argue that did more pernicious damage than in a typical case. In the trial court's definition, the court said a person acts intentionally with respect to the result of his conduct. So we don't have the predicate language of nature of conduct. We just have the result of conduct language. When, and here's the problem, they leave in the nature of conduct language, which typically modifies the nature of conduct predicate. It says when it is his conscious objective or desire to engage in the conduct or cause the result. So in this situation, the jury's being specifically directed to the fact that a person can act with intent with respect to result of his conduct in two scenarios, when it's your intent to engage in the conduct or cause the result. In the case, and the cases cited by the state, typically the scenario is both erroneous, the full definition of both intentional and knowingly are in the charge, but the application paragraph correctly written would direct the jury to which parts of the definition may apply, and you can parse that language and see that when the language says cause the result, well, we can look and see which part of that definition to use as a guide. But in this scenario, because it says with respect to result of conduct, it eliminates the nature of conduct predicate and specifically says conscious objective or desire to engage in the conduct or cause the result, the jury is led to believe that you can commit this crime just by knowing you're engaging or intending to engage in that conduct or cause the result, intending to cause the result. So we would argue that this is a more serious harm, and that the application note, the correctly written application paragraph does not cure the error. In a typical case, it might cure the error because the jury's led to refer back to the definition and they can parse the definition and see what the relevant language is. But in here, they're actually led in the wrong direction and told that it's authorized conviction by intending to engage in the conduct itself. Another important issue is, in this case, the injury is not a significant injury. We're talking about what happened is, Mr. Valencia is engaged in an altercation with an adult. The child comes and attempts to intervene. Mr. Valencia immediately turns around, and there's an elbow and a punch to the child. And the question is, there was some question as to whether this happened after or before he had turned around, whether he knew what he was doing. Well, the state would harp on the fact that the victim in this case would said, he looked at me before he did it. But the victim did not feel pain that night. There wasn't a significant injury. So I think that there is a factual basis for a jury to find that he could intend to affect the contact but not intend the result. A lot of times these cases...
How was it argued in final argument? Did the trial attorneys go into result? Did they have a result-oriented argument, or was this not even discussed in final argument?
Well,
what was the thrust of the argument?
Well, from the defense perspective, there was some argument about whether it was intentional. But they would continue to harp on the general language. Did he intend to cause injury? Did he intend to cause injury? Without necessarily fleshing out the full implication of that. But they would repeatedly ask, the question is, did they intend to cause injury?
Did the state, however, argue both possibilities?
The state did not specifically say, you don't have to find that he specifically intended to cause injury. They did not point to this definition and exploit that issue. What they did do, I would suggest, is conflate the distinction in their statements to the jury, because they basically said, when you hit a child, it's an assault, it's an injury to a child. They just leaped right over any kind of distinction between intending to affect contact and intending to affect the ultimate result in injury. I think what's unique about this case is, given the slight injury, I think it is possible to intend to affect contact without intending to cause injury, whereas some of these cases, I think it's even in the, I believe it's the Williams case that's cited by the state, they note that the distinction is kind of pedantic in that situation, where we had a person that was causing brain damage to a child, and which would likely result from being kicked or their head slammed against a wall, and they're caused permanent brain damage. Well, it's hard to imagine a scenario where you're going to affect that contact without actually intending to injure the child, or in that case, cause serious bodily injury. And in this case, given the slightness of the injury, I believe that we have this very problem, because the victim in this case also testified repeatedly that he hit me, but then he looked surprised, as if he didn't mean it. And I believe a reasonable construction of the evidence is he turned around and was frustrated that he was being interrupted from his altercation with the adult, and he quickly hit the victim in a very chaotic situation. That's what the testimony is. He hit him and then looked surprised, as if he didn't mean it. And I could see, I think the evidence strongly suggests that he was effected contact in order to get her away from him, but he didn't necessarily intend to hurt her or to injure her. And it might be a different case if it was far more serious injury.
Biggs?
Yes.
I want to stop you at that point of the event. There's an altercation going on between two adults, and this minor goes over to try to intervene and stop that altercation. There is a reaction by the appellant in which something happened. Either she testified that he hit her with his fist, and that he hit her with his elbow. Now, at that point, for you to prevail, we need to see egregious harm in the sense of this instant reaction. According to your argument, as I understand it, should be weighed against conscious, intentional conduct to injure. And given the activities of this whole event and the results that did occur, injury in fact, how do we get to egregious harm in terms of your client's position in a procedural posture that we're in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think the points you've identified, I don't believe are inconsistent with our position, which is that you have an elbow. He may or may not have looked at that time, but she says he looked when he hit me, but she didn't go to the hospital until the next day. It wasn't manifestly clear that he had injured her. Of course, bodily injury is a very low definition to meet. It's really just pain, and clearly she did go to the hospital to check it out, but we're talking about a slight bruise. And so I believe the fact that there's such a, relatively speaking, obviously no injury to a child is, I mean, there's a reason we're here, but it's relatively slight in terms of what injuries are available. And so thus, given the record where he's expressing surprise that he had done that, I think that shows that, I think the facts strongly suggest that he intended to affect contact because she was interrupting him, but not necessarily to hurt him. And I think that's consistent with what the victim consistently said in her testimony. I would point out that the jurors repeatedly was requesting testimony as regard to the timing of the incident. And they also repeatedly sent notes saying that they were deadlocked. So this was a close issue. This was a close case. I think the most important note I probably should point out is that in jury note number 4, the jury asked for clarification on 4 and 5 of page 2. Page 2 of the jury instructions, paragraph 4 specifically is the definitions of intentionally and knowingly. So it appears from the record that the jury is struggling. Reasonable construction is they're asking for some clarification on those definitions. They're struggling with how to apply those to the application paragraphs. I think another important thing to note is that the Court of Criminal Appeals has made clear in its opinion in Doherty that simply because an application paragraph's written correctly does not mean that that's the end of the inquiry, and that the court must consider all four factors. And I would point out that there is a case, and that is Cheney versus State out of Amarillo in 2010, 314 Southwest 3rd, 561, where we have erroneous definition, and that was a less egregious situation where we have the broad definition, fill it, and then you can look at the application and arguably narrow it. Well, in that situation, they found egregious harm, even though the application paragraph was written correctly, specifically cited Doherty for the proposition that you consider all four factors. It doesn't matter just that the application paragraph's written correctly. And I would point out, as I endeavored to explain in the brief, the specific way the definition's worded, I believe, would not be cured by the application paragraph. I think if the jury's reading intend to cause injury in the application paragraph and they're going back to the definition, they're not going to be able to clearly identify what the relevant language is in the definition, because this definition's already been tailored. It's been already narrowed, but in the wrong way. It's taken out the nature of the conduct language, which corresponds with the engage in conduct that is later on in the definition of 603. So by taking that out, we have the specific definition you intend with respect to the result of your conduct, identifying the result when either you intend to engage in the conduct or cause the result. And I will yield back the balance of my time.
I have a question too. Go ahead. I was just going to ask you, I saw your point about really a fact issue as to what he was intending. And isn't that the prerogative of the jury anyway?
I think the factual question, which got resolved against Mr. Valencia, was whether or not he, when he elbowed her or punched her, whether he intended to do those acts. Because there's some question as to whether he turned around when he elbowed her and then looked at her. But the testimony relied upon by the state and that the victim was admittedly consistent on was that he looked at me before he did it. And so I think that question was certainly resolved against Mr. Valencia. But the fact that that issue was resolved against Mr. Valencia doesn't answer the question of whether he intended to cause injury to the victim, just that he intended to cause effect contact. And I believe that is the province of the jury, and that was resolved against him clearly. But I don't think that gets us where we need to go, and I believe this definition contributed to the harm that the issue that the jury was apparently struggling over for some time.
Judge Sutter?
I was looking at the questions that you included in your brief, the four questions that came from the jury. And isn't a fair reading of these questions, doesn't it indicate that they actually did appreciate the distinction? That, you know, he wasn't just blindly, he just wasn't blindly defending. He gave her some look. There was some testimony that he gave her some kind of look, and that look would indicate that it was argued that he knew exactly what he was doing. It wasn't just, I'm trying to push you off, but I've got you within my sights.
I believe those questions show that they were, that this is the issue that was the focus of the trial, which was his intent at the time of this particular altercation with the elbow and the punch, and the timing of that. They seem to be struggling over the timing of that, which I think does indeed go to the issue of whether he intended to hit her or whether it was sort of an accident, and I think that was clearly resolved against him. I do believe that was a significant focus of the questions, but I don't believe that necessarily reveals that they were apprising, they understood the distinction between intending contact versus intending injury. I don't think those questions show that. I think that, and I should have pointed this out in the brief, was that in that question four, which I pointed out, where they, it's in the record, I don't believe I put that one in my brief, they asked specifically about paragraph four of the jury charge, which goes to the definitions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Biggs. Mr. Curl.
May it please the court, my name is David Curl. I'm here representing the state. I first wanted to talk about the controlling precedent and the Doherty and the decision from Cheney out of the Amarillo Court. The Court of Criminal Appeals has repeatedly held that you can't establish egregious harm, you can't even establish some harm when you preserve one of these complaints if the application portion is correct. You can't base a complaint about that from the abstract portion. Now, appellant and the Amarillo Court, they rely upon an unpublished decision from the Court of Criminal Appeals called Doherty, but the rules of appellate procedure 77.3 say it's improper for an appellant to cite that as precedent, and it's improper for a court to rely upon it. So the controlling precedent are the Medina, Patrick, and Hughes cases decided in our brief at pages 13 and 14. We think that in this regard, the El Paso court had a better approach to this in a case called In the Matter of IL, it's a 2012 decision. They said they were dealing with an unpreserved complaint like this, and they said, well, in Hughes, the Court of Criminal Appeals said you can't win even when you preserve these complaints, so you certainly couldn't show egregious harm. And they followed Hughes, and then they said, in an abundance of caution, we will go through the Almanza factors. And we believe that the court is required to follow the controlling precedent until the Court of Criminal Appeals says in a published case otherwise. The other thing about Cheney is it's a very limited case. The Amarillo Court, they relied upon three factors which are not present in our case. They said the evidence in that case was very weak. They said that the state's evidence on related to intent focused on the wrong theory of intent, and the state's jury argument was full of misstatements of the law. Now, we don't have any of those factors in our case, and in fact, the Amarillo Court has warned people citing Cheney that it's a very limited case. They, for example, in a 2011 case called Gonzalez, they said the guy, you can't really be citing Cheney for this because your case isn't really like Cheney. The next thing I wanted to talk about is the issue of the alternative theory of intent that we pled, which was knowingly, and we discussed that in our brief at page 11. There was both an intentional and a knowingly theory, and appellant makes no complaint about the knowingly theory, and we cite a case in our brief that says that weighs against any kind of finding of egregious harm. I found two more cases that make this point, that if there's a good theory of intent, you're going to have a harder time showing egregious harm. And I will provide these cases in a letter brief if the court would like, but there's a Dallas decision, it's unpublished, called Gonzalez, and an unpublished decision from the Austin court called Lewis. And those are both 2015 cases that make this point. With regard to the jury argument, appellant got to argue at length about the intent that he thought the jury had to find, and he said he told the jury they had to find that he intended to cause injury. We didn't argue anything about this abstract definition that appellant is worried about. What appellant complains about in our argument is we argued that the jury could infer his intent from his conduct, and that's a perfectly proper argument. Since he didn't confess, so we don't have anything else we could point to prove his intent. And we cite a case in our brief that makes that point, and I'll provide a letter brief with another case that makes that point called Gonzalez out of the Amarillo court. And I'd point out that the, you know, his worries about this abstract instruction, there's nothing ambiguous about the application. It says that they have to find that the defendant did intentionally or knowingly cause bodily injury to VV. So there's nothing to, they don't really have to go back to study the abstract definition to understand what that means. It's perfectly plain. The last thing I wanted to talk about is the nature of appellant's ultimate complaint. His theory is apparently that a grown man could punch a 14-year-old girl in the chest and only intend to punch her and not intend to cause her any pain. And I think that's ridiculous. It's irrational. He says that she didn't suffer significant injuries. Well, she had trouble walking, she had trouble breathing, and she went to the emergency room. That seems like it wasn't a gentle tap. I guess that's, unless there's any questions, I'll rely on our brief. Thank you.
Mr. Carl, the court will allow you to file that post-submission letter brief if you can do so within 10 days of today, and then opposing counsel will have an opportunity to respond within 10 days of that date.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Biggs.
Your Honor, in response to a few points raised by the state, first, while it is true, and I mentioned this in my initial argument, but it probably failed to fully flesh out the fact that the victim did go to the hospital and was having trouble breathing, but there was some question as to what specifically had caused that particular extent of pain, because there's evidence in the record that the appellant, Mr. Valencia, had opened a door and hit her in the ribs with the doorknob by accident. And that's even the victim's own testimony with regard to that. And there were some subsequent acts that were not the focus of the trial. The trial was on this initial punch. And so while she did go to the hospital later, even those injuries are relatively modest on balance, but some of those may have been caused by unintentional acts. And the only focus of this, and that was undisputed, the focus of the trial was on the first time that he punched her. And so I believe that we can't just infer back from the fact that she ultimately went to the hospital that this must have been pretty severe, because there were some subsequent acts that took place, may or may not have been intentional, that weren't the focus of the trial, that weren't the actual charge. The issue with regard to knowingly being correctly correct, I would point out two things. First, in a case that discusses this, Medina, knowingly there was an issue where, or knowingly, there could have been an alternative basis for guilt. And I believe in that case, knowingly was incorrect and intent was correct, if I'm not mistaken. But in that case, we're again talking about a situation where it's almost ridiculous to be drawing a distinction between nature of conduct and result of conduct when you're talking about, in that case it was a murder, talking about essentially a drive-by shooting. Okay, well, you're clearly intending by the nature of your conduct to engage in an act that's clearly dangerous to human life, and you, by engaging that act, you necessarily are aware of the result of your conduct, so that even if the jury had been applying the erroneous definition of knowingly shooting someone, well, by engaging that knowing conduct, by knowingly clearly engaging in that clearly dangerous to human life, you're necessarily going to know the result of your conduct, which is that someone could get killed. And so the distinction, again, I think that to steal a word from the Williams case is sort of pedantic in that scenario. But here I think the actual distinction between intending to engage in the conduct and intending to cause injury is really brought to bear. I don't think the fact that the knowingly one was correctly tailored necessarily gets you where you need to go. And I would point out that the knowingly definition is narrowed. It's not like the knowingly definition is written broadly so that, okay, well, it has both the nature of conduct and result of conduct, engage in conduct, cause the result. The full definition of knowingly from 603 is not in there. It's actually narrowly tailored where it says a person acts knowingly with respect to the result of their conduct when your conduct, you're aware, is reasonably certain to cause the result. So they've identified the situation where you act knowingly with result to your conduct, okay? And it's when you're reasonably certain to you have knowledge or reasonably certain to cause the result. Well, intentionally, we've narrowed it, but not we haven't really narrowed it. We've said with respect to the result of your conduct, there's two situations. Unlike the knowingly, there's two situations. So I don't believe that the fact that the knowingly one has been narrowly tailored necessarily is going to cure the issue with intent. Finally, we would submit that the Doherty case is precedent. It is cited by a court of appeals for the proposition that all the factors must be weighed. The judge relying on the dissenting judge from the grant of cert in Doherty was upset based on the view that Medina should apply. Well, she has a dissenting opinion. And this is coming from the Court of Criminal Appeals, and we have an Amarillo Court of Appeals applying that as precedent. So we would submit that is precedent the court can rely on. And we would respectfully request that the court vacate the conviction and remand the case to the trial court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Biggs. Mr. Curl, we appreciate your arguments today. Your case is now submitted, and you are excused.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll proceed to case number 2 on our docket and give you all time to get set up. Ex parte, Andre Derossier.